Mr. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time you pass my doorstop. With the chicken and the brisket and the marrow and the giblets, Mr. Cutlets, spend some time with me. I know it's crazy, but it's true. It's not worth eating if it lacks the greasy. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you burst into the kitchen, you grab a fist of meatballs and a bone for wishing. With the bacon and the lamb chops and the scrapple and the ham hock, Mr. Cutlets, spend some time with me. Spend some time. Spend some time with me.
And I'm Mr. Cutlets, Josh Ozersky. This is the Mr. Cutlets Show. I'm the National City Restaurant Editor for City Search. And we're here with the Heritage Radio Network in the back garden at Roberta's. They got pizzas and sweetbreads cooking away. We're here thanks to the sponsorship of the Hearst Ranch in San Simeon and its various grass-fed animals. And I have some good guests today. I have my my beautiful co-host, Stephanie Cohen, of the New York Post.
Hello.
And we've got my friend Anthony Goncalves here still from 42 Restaurant in White Plains, the best restaurant in Westchester by far. It's kind of a faint praise, really. I think you would be one of the best restaurants in,
thank you.
In any actual city. Our featured guest today is none other than my friend and colleague, English Nick Solaris from Serious Eats.
Good afternoon.
And Nick has identical research interests as my own and has written very evocatively and very knowledgeably about meat, first on his site, The Beef Aficionado, and then subsequently for Serious Eats on A Hamburger Today and Serious Eats New York. And Nick, I always look at your work with some professional jealousy, because you have this $8,000 camera. I'm reduced to walking around with a cell phone camera, and you've really done some terrific work.
Thank you.
Of the things that I've seen you do lately, the one that stood out most was you had this incredible photo feature in A Hamburger Today about the lost burger brigadoon, you know, of North Jersey.
And of the slider more generally.
Well, I think we should clarify to people, when we say slider, we don't mean the little mini hamburgers, like mini Kobe burgers.
The slider, the term slider has been sort of used to describe anything that's small at this point. But for the purist, and, you know, after reading your book and you know, talking to George Motz, the other hamburger guy from New York. And, you know, a slider is a very specific preparation of hamburger. And it's basically, it's essentially steam griddling.
Yeah, well,
you're putting a burger on the griddle.
Right.
And you're actually putting onions on that, which is adding moisture. And you're topping everything with a bun.
Right.
And that creates this sort of wonderful,
very, very tender. They started calling it a slider because of the ease with which it both entered and exited your gastrointestinal system.
Right, which is not perhaps the most appealing.
But they called it, I think we should, I really feel that it would be returning to the sort of essential, original meaning of hamburger. That was what a hamburger was. Like, a hamburger wasn't this 9-ounce behemoth topped with, like, kimchi, pickles, or whatever kind of garbage. Like, it was this minute, very simple, almost like a petit four. I mean, just nothing.
Right.
There was no crunchy elements at all on it. And
getting back to Motz, what he always described it as, you have your hamburger in one hand and your coffee and your cigarette in the other.
No.
And that's what...
A hamburger and coffee?
Yeah, that's what...
I mean, a coffee and a cigarette in the other hand and a hamburger in one hand. And that's, you know, that was the size of a slider.
Right.
And almost, you know, what the immediacy that it represented, in addition to having a jolt of Joe and some nicotine, you got your protein and your grease fix in at the same
this
time.
This is predates McDonald's? What is
This predates McDonald's by decades.
Yeah.
Like, this would be made in a house?
No, this would be made in a White Castle.
The hamburger always had, its primary existence was in the public sphere. Hamburger's not really itself when it's at home.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like if you saw, like,
like a porterhouse.
I was going to say, like, if you saw Valentino or Marc Jacobs padding around their apartment in boxer shorts, that's not the real them. Or, like, if you saw Tom Ford in his boxer shorts and, like, a wife beater, if that's what he wears at home, that's not the real Tom Ford. Like, the hamburger is a public object.
Right.
But anyway, the special poignancy for Nick and I is that there are actually a number of restaurants that still serve this hamburger, as it were, almost preserved in amber. You know, I mean, real...
You're tasting history.
Yeah, I mean,
things have not... purveyors have not changed. Butchers have not changed.
Right.
The method has not changed. And
the room hasn't changed. Sometimes right. The man itself... You know, that old coot that was making the ones at White Diamond when we went there.
Right.
Nick, tell the story of what happened to us at White Diamond.
Well... What happened at White Diamond was that I discovered a true gem of a hamburger spot, reported it. I take a Zersky there, and the place gets closed the next week.
It hadn't changed for 80 years. And then when I get to it, there, it closed 5 days later.
Like some biblical plague of hamburger.
I was like the dire wolf.
You ate all the meat.
I was the Ted McGinley of
Maybe that's what it was, Josh. We just ate them out of business. or we ate so many burgers that they could retire.
You know what? You could eat... I mean, do you remember? It was $1.30... for a burger, and it had that soft white bun, totally untoasted, like from Aldi's or some kind of place like that. And then they had like the monster burger was something like 3 ounces, and that right. was like,
but all based on the same 2 ounce patty increment. In other words,
yeah,
a big burger,
they'll just
blob them together and slap it on the grill.
Right.
But that's you're getting away from what they do well, and,
right.
and really the 2 ounce burger is
what's
the
story though.
Well, the story is that
it's your show.
Well, I mean, I definitely, this is one thing that does serve well being framed in my kind of over dramatic and grandiloquent language, that these places that were so rare and so precious and such a kind of a wormhole into the cultural history of the hamburger, not 10 years ago, not 20 years ago, but 60 and 70 years ago, like preceding McDonald's by 10 or 20 years, like when the 50s... and the Mel's Diner hamburger, you know, stand culture was in the distant future. Like these were when it was still like for factory workers, like a snack food for factory workers, right. like essentially like a falafel balls now would be or something. And there's very few of these places. And Nick went to all of them and he took pictures of them, very nice pictures. And he did a sort of a compendium recently on A Hamburger Today, which I thought was a very important historical, you know, project.
Nick, how did you become obsessed with hamburgers? Why are people obsessed with hamburgers?
Well, it's not obvious to you.
It's so good. I guess there's not that many of you.
Well,
two of them are right here.
There are more of us than just, it's not like we're sort of like the you know, like the I guess you, I'm trying to think of the analogy. We would be like the elder statesman of the movement or something, but there's a million, the only reason we write, we have audiences that read about it. People are into it.
Oh, I know. But he reads about Nazi literature and hamburgers.
I know.
That's
let's not talk about
no
that side. That's not that side of English Nick's
It's a sort
interest.
Of a strange obsession.
Well, I think we need to go into the psychopathology of this on a deeper level in the next segment. But in the meantime, I'm Josh Ozersky, and this is the Mr. Cutlet Show, and this is Heritage Radio.
Farm way back up in the woods. I was so ragged that folks used to call me Patches. Papa used to tease me about it, cause deep down inside he was hurt cause he'd done all he could. My papa was a great old man. I can see him with a shovel in his hand. See, education he never had. He did wonders when the times got bad. The little money from the crops he raised barely paid the bills we made. Oh, life had him down to the ground. When he tried to get up, life would kick him back down. One day, Papa called me to his dying bed, put his hands on my shoulder, then in tears he said, Patches, I'm depending on you, son, to pull the family through. My son, it's all days later, Papa passed away. I became a man that day. So I told Mama I was gonna quit school, but she said that was Daddy's strictest rule. So every morning before I went to school, I fed the chickens and I chopped wood too. Sometimes I felt that I couldn't go on. I wanted to leave, just run away from home. But I would remember what my daddy said, with tears in his eyes on his dying bed. He said, Patches, I'm depending on you, son. I tried to do my best. It's up to you to do the rest.
Then one day a strong rain came and washed all the crops away. All right, so I'm Josh Ozersky, and we're here at Roberta's, one of my favorite restaurants, and I'm here with some of my favorite people. We have Stephanie Cohen from the New York Post, Anthony Goncalves, the brilliant chef from 42, and my friend and peer
and
English
rival.
Nick and rival English Nick Solaris from Serious Eats. I don't really think of Nick as a rival. We need more people writing about these things, not less of them. But Stephanie, you expressed some strange skepticism that people would want to be, you know, obsessively attached to the apotheosizing of hamburgers.
Why not hot dogs?
Well, hot dog is just it's just another sausage.
I think hot dogs taste better than hamburgers.
It was not a matter of, well, so what? I mean, a lot of things probably taste better than hamburgers. Nothing has the universal semiotic power of the hamburger.
But
nothing
it's
has
true. Why not, though?
There's a universality of it. That a hamburger is recognizable anywhere in the world.
So is a hot dog.
Not really.
Not in the
hot
same way.
Hot dog is a German thing anyway.
Yeah, and hot dogs are much more regionally defined. I mean, the fact is that...
And nobody loves them. Nobody loves a hot dog.
That's not true.
When's the last time you hear somebody say, oh, you got to go wait in line and have this incredible hot dog?
Hot dogs are having a comeback.
In Chicago.
You know, I think that the hot dog comeback was eclipsed by fried chicken.
That's
and actually,
true. That's
and actually
true.
Completely smothered by fried chicken.
Mm.
Smothered
and fried.
Yeah.
Basted.
Sounds amazing. Sounds great for everything but a hamburger, frankly.
You know, I mean, like, it's one of those things that either you have, you know, I mean...
It mirrors, from reading your book, the history of pop culture and industrialization and food.
Yeah.
And
also the interstate
factory.
Highway system.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, and it doesn't... It
commoditization.
Doesn't just, right. And it doesn't...
And the whole factory farming system on some
true.
Really evil level.
And pricing and the... You know,
right.
And
ethnicity.
And commercial and marketing.
No, but it's true. Mentioning ethnicity, it really is the first non-ethnic... It's the truly American ethnic food.
It really is.
That doesn't really have... I mean, okay.
Okay.
You can argue that the name Hamburg
from
Germany. But it's really...
So everyone eats hamburgers
from Europe in
so
many ways. Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a McDonald's in every city of every state. And not that I'm using that as a sort of paradigm for what a hamburger is, but...
It's not regional
at
all.
Well, there are regional variations on the hamburger. You go to Connecticut and they steam them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's nasty.
Well...
No, but you're right. I mean, obviously. And then that's the whole... But that's essential to the American project. I mean, what is our... You know, say, out of many, one, right? E pluribus unum. So the unity... The homogeneity and the heterogeneity, the many, the oneness of hamburgers. You know, it's like the way the Catholic Church had an essential authority, an essential body, but it was able to absorb all of the various peoples it conquered. I mean, they would sort of just modify their pagan gods with saints. In the same way, there's regional hamburgers, and then there's the larger sort of body and doctrine of hamburgerdom.
Did anyone read the front page of the New York Times today?
About hamburgers.
Yeah,
there's
the burger that shattered her life.
Did you see this? Huge article. It's like 8,000 words about some woman that ate
E. coli. The trail of
E. coli
shows flaws in ground beef inspection system. How do you address this?
This is
disgusting.
No, this is a non-issue. First of all, no man of spirit would ever let himself be infected with E. coli germs and a molecule.
This is me knocking on wood, but I've only ever gotten sick.
So we can't talk about agribusiness.
Well, no, we can. I mean,
that's
absolutely.
Bad. Those, I know a lot about that kind of hamburger meat, because that kind of hamburger meat is the antithesis of what we like to eat. And that's one of the reasons why we have taken Pat LaFrieda as a figure of special veneration in the hamburger community, because if everyone would make that hamburgers like him, no one would ever get E. coli or
that's
any other.
But all you guys are talking about the hamburger being this iconic food is based on agribusiness and this exact kind of
Well, then, you know, that's part of the American. That's the part of the American. I mean, America has original sin attached to it. It's like when you talk about American democracy, it's part and parcel with slavery and racism and the disenfranchisement.
And E. coli.
I mean, I'm not saying that it's it's not paradise. It's not an Eden. It's part of America.
So the hamburger you're talking about is not actually the hamburger. That's the Democratic burger that.
No, we don't like the Democratic. We don't like the Carl's Jr. hamburgers or whatever.
Or the McDonald's or...
Yeah, you don't eat McDonald's. Neither of you.
I did for an April Fool's joke.
Yeah, that was good. And we remember when we ate that horrible hamburger on St. Mark's Place?
Well, I didn't eat that. I couldn't even...
Literally, it was sick-making. I mean,
God bless that you could actually swallow that thing. It was...
Yeah, I can... Testament. I there's very little in the way of hamburger-type things that I can't swallow. But, Nick, while we're on the subject of iconic foods and... Just so that we don't make our listeners actually cut their throats in boredom and frustration. You recently came back from Naples. I mean, pizza is one of the great iconic New York foods. And there's this big Pizza Napolitana, Vera Pizza Napolitana movement. You actually went to Naples and ate the Naples version of it. And I would be curious for you to tell us how it stacks up against the New York versions.
Well, the only place that I thought that came close to what I had in Naples in terms of selling a Neapolitan pie was the sadly defunct Una Pizza Neapolitana on...
another one like White Diamond that we drove out of business.
Yeah.
What happened? It's Motorino now.
It's now Motorino.
Yeah. Have you been there since it was Motorino?
I have.
Is it? And it's not as good as the other guy?
Listen, Motorino's very good pizza, but it's not... It's...
What's the difference? Not,
well, what he was doing with the dough was really...
Like, can you sort of describe it a little?
Especially for... I don't know if Stephanie ever ate there or if...
Yeah, I did.
Okay, I mean, he was using unleavened bread, so he would take a yeast starter from the prior dough. It was all done by hand. It was artisanal in a sense that it doesn't even happen in Naples anymore. All the ingredients were imported from Naples. He had an oven imported from Naples at ridiculous expense. So he's setting up everything to try to recreate what's going on in Naples, which is a pie that most Americans would frankly find not to their liking. If you grew up with crisp crusts and, you know, a bevy of toppings on top.
Or the nice, low-moisture, greasy mozzarella that we all love.
Exactly. They're
so
using
much.
A buffalo mozzarella, which is very, very moist. The tomatoes, the fresher they are, the more liquid they give off. They put oil on top of the pizza when it's cooking. So... You're dealing with a soupy melange of a pie, which some... And you're making a face.
Yeah, no.
Because you've experienced that in the worst sense, which is the people that are doing it in this country, and it really literally comes out like soup. But for some reason in Naples, whether it's the environment, the terroir, whether it's the history of the place, or a collusion of all of those things, the pizza just has a magic there that I've never found in a pie in America in terms of that style. But American pizza and what we've done to pizza should be lauded and embraced.
This is a deep topic, and I bet Anthony has something to say about it too. Why don't we take a little break?
A deep dish topic.
And then we'll come back. This is Josh Ozersky on the Mr. Cutlets Show. Josh Ozersky, And this is the Mr. Cutlets Show over here at Roberta's.
Did you try
Heritage.
To come in on key on that one?
I tried.
it was a valiant effort.
I know. Always dissonance is always my watchword, Nick. I'm here thanks to the generous sponsorship of the Hearst Ranch in San Simeon and their grass-fed animals. Now, we were talking about pizza, and you were talking about, in particular, Tony Mangieri and his product at Una Pizza Napolitana and why that was the only one that was like, you know, Naples. But what I'm always saying is I feel that we are being oppressed personally by this swarm of Napolitana clones. I think that the pizza took a big step forward evolutionarily in New York with the introduction of a low-moisture mozzarella, not the garbage they use at the Ray's or whatever, but like a grande mozzarella, something like that that like actually melts into the cheese. And so you get the familiar...
Into the pizza.
I mean, into the sauce, yeah. is what mm-hmm. I mean. So you get a familiar orange melange that then, once it coagulates, has got some saltiness and greasiness to it, and the thin crust, which, I mean, you know, tipsag to me is like, if I have to eat a pizza... Like, I saw a thing, Robin did a thing about it, Franny's, or one of those terrible places that I hate so much, like... You know those little you know.
But how do you really feel about that place?
Well, look, I don't even know them. They must despise me. So, but the point is, it was like you're supposed to eat it, and the diagram was like taking it and folding it over because there was no other way to eat it. They won't slice it for you, God forbid. I don't think they even give you an. I guess they must give you a knife and fork. But like, bottom line is, if you have to fold it over, that's a calzone. I mean, you know, I mean, that's how structurally unsound it is. And the focaccia, you know, that mozzarella di bufala, first of all, once it's hot, it's already no good. Just like if it's refrigerated, it's no good. It has to be eaten at room temperature. And, you know, once it melts and gives off all that water, it's like putting tomatoes on
hamburgers. So you like these so-called democratic foods, but you only like the very high-end
That's exactly
versions
right.
of them made That's in New York
right,
City.
The most exalted.
That's right. That's exactly
the artisanal.
Right. You don't need any of the real stuff.
No.
No.
No. You know what I mean? Like, life is too short for platonic romances, savory desserts, and second-rate pizza.
I agree.
There, I've said it. Anthony, you must have an opinion about this. Which do you like better, the Vera Pizza Napolitana style or the traditional New York low moisture mozzarella style?
I'm gonna go with the Italian style.
You are?
Yeah.
Now, why do you think that it's better?
To be honest with you, I mean, you know, before I went to Italy and actually had pizza in Napoli, I wouldn't be able to. I think it would have been a different answer you would have gotten. But once I was there and started to eat that way, coming back here, it was just a huge disappointment. And, you know, I've gone as far as New Haven to try Pepe's and, you know.
Which is very good pizza.
But
I think what's good about that pizza is that rather than trying to recreate something, what they've actually done is embrace local ingredients and local terroir and local. You know,
they're clever about it.
And they're making something that's really sort of that speaks of the place and the time that it comes from.
But their mentality, as well as from back home, with the ovens running at 750, it's very, very important. And being able to get a pie in and out in 2.5 minutes.
But they have a crisper crust than you'll find in Naples.
It is, most definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you would be happy. You could eat it with your hands. Oh, which is really good. Which all your complaints about Neapolitan pizza, if you just pick up a knife and fork like a civilized gentleman.
You know what?
He doesn't like any food that requires utensils.
I mean, yeah. Should I start eating egg rolls with a knife and fork, too? Like, why do I have to
eat shouldn't
eat
egg rolls at all, but that's another story.
Pizza rolls in Italy are... It's a serious thing. It's like a barista, you know? They've got the touch.
At the same time, what I really like about it is that it's treated so... It's not that it's nonchalant, but it's so... It's just part of life. It's
natural.
It's not fetishized the way we have radio programs about food or blogs and or we have careers about writing about food. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, maybe if they had people like that, they wouldn't be turning out the same tired things every day like they do.
There's no real cry in Naples of the 3,000 pizzerias in Naples for a Domino's-style party. You can walk down the street holding in your hand.
That's not happening.
Now, let me tell you something. I went yesterday to DeFara, which, you know, is a place that I hold with an almost religious veneration, almost an awe, in fact. And the old man, the master, Dom DeMarco, the Saint of Avenue J, when he cuts his pizza, he has little trimmings come off the dough, and he throws them against the, you know, back marble or whatever. So I was there, and I said, Dom, can I please have those trimmings? And he gave me a bunch of them. And I had that soft, supple dough in my hands at home, and it's so yeasty and so incredible. There's no way anybody making a better dough than that. And then I took it, and I stretched it out, and I had a 10-pound bag of La Frida ground meat, and I put it in a pan with the fairway fruity Spanish Gata Herdez olive oil, and I prit it. I cooked it so the bottom was greasy and crusty.
That sounds disgusting.
And then I put the La Frida ground beef all over the top of it, and some salt and some pepper and some Greek oregano, or maybe with Sicilian oregano. You know, the kind that comes on the long stalks. Let me tell you something. No sauce, no cheese, no nothing. Just grease and dough and salt and meat.
How did you eat? I can't picture it. What, you ate it out of the pan?
I can't picture it. It's still in the shirt.
I eat it like I, you know, I took it like I take all my favorite meals at the sink. And I actually gave one to Denise. And we're off the carbs now, so it was especially illicit pleasure.
Mm.
But I have to say that it was truly transcendent.
What did she say?
She was like overwhelmed. I mean, how could you not be? I mean, the thing is, when you have Dom's dough and you actually get to smell it and feel and play with it and whatever, you realize like the fun. It's the fundament of that pizza and his incredible passata, you know, and the three cheeses and everything else. Like the concentration of flavors, the way that they come together, and then there's that crust is just what really, really it all rests on. And I don't know what any of these guys are doing. I don't know if it's got a yeast from yesterday or an unleavened double-aught flour, whatever the hell it is. It's better than anybody else, and there's no one in Italy could possibly make a better pizza than that. And I say that as a total ignoramus.
Well, you can only say it in that way.
Do you like saltwater taffy? Aren't you from being from Atlantic City,
no,
do you fetishize
bad.
Any of that?
No, I can't.
What do you
bad.
Like from Atlantic City? Did anything come out of there other than taffy?
You know,
and Dazowski?
I mean, I used to really enjoy the Italian American, you know, the veal parm, the red sauce, like they call it, the veal parmesan.
But that's not AC.
Well, it was a hotbed of that kind of culture. There was old time restaurants. I read in Savor about this.
Sub shops are famous in Atlantic City.
Yeah, I mean, they have the White House and Sacco's and some of these other places. But those sandwiches are not that good. I don't like a meat sandwich that's got seven different kinds of Italian
Me either.
Ham on it. I think that's like, what's the point?
I know.
It's like trying to drive five cars at once or something, you know? And the cheesesteak, let's face it, especially in the traditional form, has a pretty low ceiling.
And it's not from Atlantic City.
And it's not from Atlantic City, but there are certain things that, you know, like always, you know, it's kind of a Proust.
But no slider restaurants left there?
There was never any when I was there, you know? I mean, there was no, I got that stuff just here and there. I mean, little stolen, furtive, rueful memories from my empty childhood and loveless adolescence.
No, but your favorite was...
These fragments I have shored against my ruin, you know.
You liked Melba toast in America.
Oh, that's my... That was as a lonely child, and to this day, the old English garlic rounds, you know, yeah. And you get a four of them. This is what I would do as a child. I would get the four old English Melba rounds, garlic flavor. They don't make it now. They only have roasted garlic. It's no good.
You know what? I'm sure the garlic one wasn't that good either, in retrospect.
You get a slice of American cheese, and you fold it in half twice, quartering it evenly. And in one hand, you have the four quarters of cheese. In the other hand, you have the four crackers. And then you go and you sit in the white velvet chair, and you watch The Love Boat. Not velvet, there was a white plastic chair, and I'd watch The Love Boat, and then you'd eat the four of them, and then you'd be like, oh, should I go back and get another four? You know, like, oh, well, all right, why not, you know?
And you had to multiply it times an exponent of
Time, right, times times L over the L, let L equal loneliness over the power of despair, you know. Anyway, I'd like to thank English Nick Solaris from Serious Seats for being here. Please, by all means, check out his work. Anthony Goncalves from 42.
Thank you.
Really one of the most gifted and unique chefs in New York. And my good friend Stephanie Cohen, who it looks like might want to be a quasi-regular co-host
pain
here.
Pain in the ass.
You know, so...
Try.
I'm Josh Ozersky, City Search's National Restaurant Editor, also known as Mr. Cutlets.
Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time you pass my doorstop with the chicken and the brisket and the marrow and the gib.